Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday the 22nd of January, 2024. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jeff Cassett and Carol Lockard. Here's Carol with our first story.
And hello, everyone. This is something we're probably all concerned with. Ice becomes concerned with warmer weather. Temperatures rising into the mid-30s for the upcoming week. Warmer air will continue moving into the Quad City region Monday and will keep high temperatures in the mid-30s through Sunday. According to the forecast issued by the National Weather Service, Davenport, temperatures were to rise overnight Sunday into Monday with a south wind of about 15 miles per hour. Monday's high is expected to peak at about 33 degrees, which also will be the overnight low heading into Tuesday. However, there is a chance of sleet after 4 a.m. During the day Monday, there is a 30% chance of wintry mix that could include rain, snow, freezing rain, and sleet. Chances of precipitation rise to 90% Monday night into Tuesday. There is a chance of rain and freezing rain Monday night that is expected to become all rain by 3 a.m. on Tuesday. New ice accumulation of 0.1 inch is possible. During the day Tuesday, there is a chance of rain before 9 a.m., then a chance of rain and snow between 9 a.m. and noon. Little to no snow accumulation is expected on Tuesday. What is of concern is freezing rain and sleet on the roadways on Monday and Tuesday. If your road is like my road, it's already caked in snow and salt, meteorologist Andy Irvin said. Our concern is for untreated surfaces, the ones that actually look like a road. Even though the air temperature may be 33 degrees, if temperatures of the roadway is still in the 20s, you've got a problem, he said. People will need to be careful driving and walking in case there is ice on roadways or pedestrian paths. There won't be any ice or snow accumulations on trees and power lines, Irvin said. High temperatures on Wednesday through Sunday are expected to hold to the middle 30s under cloudy skies with overnight lows in the mid-30s. There is a 70% chance of precipitation on Wednesday and Thursday. Irvin said, I don't think we'll get warm enough to do anything to the ice on the rivers and creeks. It would have to get much warmer, and I don't think we're going to lose our snow quickly at all. There are tons of it on the ground. With the warmer weather and the rain, we'll see a compression of the snow, he said, and then there will be gradual melt. But the snow is not going anywhere anytime soon. According to the Climate Prediction Center, 8 to 14-day outlook, there is a 70% to 80% chance of above normal temperatures for the Quad City region through February 3rd. Precipitation is forecast to be near normal during that time frame. Normal snowfall for January is 10.8 inches. Through the 20th, the Quad Cities has received 27.2 inches of snow. The normal rainfall for the month of January is 1.66 inches. The average temperature for January through Saturday is 18.7 degrees, which is 4.9 degrees below normal. Jeff?
Report from Bettendorf Community Schools, their school board, says middle school renovations are discussed. The school board okays a calendar for 24 and 25. Bettendorf school leaders approved the district's 2024-25 calendar and talked about future middle school renovations last week. With all board members present, the Wednesday, January 17 meeting kicked off with a public hearing on the proposed 24-25 calendar. This later saw unanimous board approval, as did all consent agenda items. During communications, Director Linda Smithson urged the board to research Iowa's area education agencies, that's AEAs, and their impact on schools and students, particularly in the wake of Iowa lawmakers' proposed budget and administrative changes to the AEAs. Other board members, Andrew Champion and Richard Lynch, echoed similar sentiments. Board members also discussed the district's recent cancellations because of dangerous winter weather conditions. Directors Ryan McGivern, Kevin Freaking, and Board President Patrick Larkin spoke about their recent tours at Mark Twain and Neil Armstrong Elementary School. Several, including Superintendent Michelle Morse, thanked district maintenance, operational staff, and other officials for their work in keeping students safe during this time. Morse also thanked building staff, students, and families for their flexibility in navigating the school cancellations. Also in her report, Morse noted recent talks with lobbyists and local lawmakers about the upcoming 2024 legislative session. Advocating for AEAs, she said, is a high priority issue for many Iowa administrators and educators. The board also took time to recognize the 14 high school students accepted into the annual Southeast Iowa Bandmasters Association Honor Band. These students performed at the University of Women's Voxman Music Hall on Saturday. In the Bettendorf Education Association report, President Emily Collison gave a rundown of union members' recent building highlights at Herbert Hoover Elementary School. With negotiating teams now set, she listed the following as items the BEA continues to discuss and prioritize. First, long-term solutions for the ongoing sub shortage, alongside a continued focus on current district vacancies and needs. Second, support with special education and the English Language Learners Program. Third, reminding members to follow the proper chain of command and to document all related conversations regarding any union-related concerns or inquiries. Collison took time to thank building administrators, saying monthly BEA meetings have been collaborative and solution-focused. Before closing, she also expressed the BEA's support for Iowa AEAs, urging attendees to contact their local legislators and the Perry community in wake of the recent shooting at Perry High School. In her regular report, Melissa Laufenberg, Bettendorf Educational Support Association president, noted new and ongoing paraeducator trainings and gave her regular staff shout-outs. While Charlie Silver, student board representative, didn't have much to report because of recent school cancellations, he spoke about how AEA services helped him in elementary school. Before voting on action items, Kurt Pratt, Bettendorf School's Director of Operations, gave an update on plans for Bettendorf Middle School's phased renovation project, joined by representatives from partnering firm Bray Architects. This project proposes to demolish 60,500 square feet of the existing middle school building, making room for a new renovated addition to include a wrestling facility, a nurse's suite, a staff lounge and four offices, a kitchen, and designated space for instructional coaches and AEA consultants. Design plans won't be finalized until August, according to the district's tentative project schedule. In the meantime, Bettendorf school leaders are weighing three overall phasing plans. Each plan differs in timeline and impact to existing middle school structure. However, the end result in terms of new building features and programming would be the same for each phasing option. Options A and C, for example, propose to build a second floor onto the middle school, housing 16 and 18 classrooms, respectively. The cafeteria would remain on the western side of the building with option A, while the other two propose moving it to a more centralized location. The new wrestling facility's location varies notably between each plan, while each tentative design plans including classroom and office spaces, are more closely aligned. Following the update, Bettendorf School Board members inquired with Bray about developing a pros and cons list for each option. District leaders will also gather input from middle school staff, Pratt said, and may seek feedback from other stakeholders down the road. Once more details emerge and input is gathered, the district will bring a final project budget and phasing option to the board for approval. To view all presentations and board discussions in full, watch Wednesday's meeting live stream on Bett School Board YouTube channel. Next, the board unanimously approved Wednesday's remaining action items. The highlights included December financials, updates to the following board policies, the discipline of students who make threats of violence or cause incidents of violence, student internet/network appropriate use regulation, and school nutrition program notices for non-discrimination. Finally, the district's 24-25 family handbook. The board's next meeting will be at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February 7th. Carol?
And in Illinois, court upholds pension merger. Springfield, Illinois. The Illinois Supreme Court on Friday unanimously upheld a 2019 law that consolidated nearly 650 municipal police and firefighter pension funds, rejecting arguments from pension fund members that their voting power was diluted unconstitutionally. The law, which Governor J.B. Pritzker signed soon after it passed with overwhelming bipartisan majorities in the General Assembly, combined 649 individual pension funds into just two, one to manage investments and payouts for retired police officers and the other that does the same for retired firefighters. The consolidation promised access to larger investments previously not available to hundreds of small individual funds, all in the hopes of yielding greater returns. Combining the funds into two also eliminated administrative costs paid out of the individual pension funds. But nearly three dozen pensioners and 17 of the individual pension funds sued over the law. They argued that they were wronged because members now vote for the fund's oversight boards on a statewide basis rather than selecting five of their peers for the local boards as they used to. Attorney Daniel Konachek, who represented the plaintiffs in the oral argument to the high courts in November, said his client's votes were, quote, completely, undeniably diluted, end quote, which he contended violated the state constitution's pension protection clause. That provision, which the Supreme Court has consistently ruled is ironclad, states membership in any government retirement system constitutes an enforceable contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired. But all seven justices on the Illinois Supreme Court rejected Konachek's argument. Writing for her colleagues, Chief Justice Mary Jane Theis cut down Konachek's assertion that this case was similar to a 2014 case in which the court ruled the Pension Protection Clause prevented the state from reducing health care benefits to retirees. Theis wrote, in contrast, the ability to vote in elections for local pension board members is not such a constitutionally protected benefit, nor is the ability to have local board members control and invest pension funds, Theis wrote. Theis is the only justice still left on the court from when it heard a series of high-profile pension benefit cases, including the 2014 challenge, had also been skeptical in her questioning of Konachek during oral arguments in November. Simply put, the law has no impact on plaintiffs receiving their promised monetary benefits, Theis wrote in Friday's opinion. And now we'll go back to Jeff.
Geneseo grad earns the highest. She earns the Gold Award for her work on a composting program. Like many girls, Megan Plumley joined Girl Scouts in kindergarten. Unlike many who join, she stuck with it. Around fifth grade or middle school, I realized not a lot of other kids stick with Girl Scouts, Plumley, who's now 18, said. I realized I could make a difference in my community, especially being older. Case in point, she received the 2024 Gold Award, the highest honor a Girl Scout can earn, for launching a composting program in Geneseo, her hometown. Reflecting back to middle school, Plumley said the bronze award she'd won earlier was another impetus for her ongoing love of Girl Scouts. I got to help out with younger Girl Scouts, so it became important to me to help younger generations find their passion in Girl Scouts, wildlife, and all that in general, she said. Now studying wildlife ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, Plumley said the idea behind her Gold Award-winning project came after hearing about yard waste issues at the parking lot at Cole Cabin, a property Girl Scouts use for daycare and other programs. A great way to reduce the amount of waste being thrown into the parking lot would be to add a compost bin, she said. They couldn't have it on Cole Cabin's property because they were afraid it would make the problem worse. So I decided to actually have it on local property where Girl and Boy Scouts could still use it. Plumley also built bird, bat, and owl houses to install around Cole Cabin, which did receive composting buckets to collect waste to take to the bins. A really big part of Girl Scouts is making sure we're respecting the outdoors and all local wildlife, she said. I thought it was a great experience, giving back to something that means so much to me. For the past three summers, Plumley has been a camp counselor at Cole Cabin, making her project even more rewarding. The girls' summer camp participants are actually going to get hands-on opportunities to work with the bin, she said. That compost is going to be given to local community gardens. In the meantime, Plumley and her family are collecting yard and food waste to store in the compost bin. A lot of people in the community seem to be really excited about it, she said. We're giving a family friend some compost for a Boy Scouts Eagle Award project where they built a community garden. The city of Geneseo has expressed interest, too. While her compost program isn't scaled to serve all of Geneseo, Plumley said talks with city officials have been reassuring. They were still interested about making it more publicized for the community to use, she said. They were very interested in my project. It was on a smaller scale than what they needed, so I'm hoping we can make it kind of like a bigger version so the entire city can use it. That would be awesome. With this kind of local impact, Plumley said her project was well worth all the planning, work, and sometimes intimidating time constraints. Even if I hadn't gotten the Gold Award, it still meant a lot to me, she said. It was just really a neat experience. Not a lot of people have that honor, and it was nice to give back. Coincidentally, Plumley wasn't the first in her family to reach this achievement. Her mother did, too. I think I'm a fourth-generation Girl Scout, Plumley said, so it was really important for me to do it. All things considered, she hopes her project and subsequent award inspire young Girl Scouts. I really wanted to educate them about not giving up on their goals and bettering the environment, Plumley said. Even if you're under a time constraint and things aren't working out, there's always a solution. You're just going to look from a different angle. Carol?
And here are a couple of obituaries for not local people, but people that you might know of. Mary Weiss, lead singer of Shangri-Las, dies at the age of 75. Mary Weiss, the lead singer of the 1960s pop group The Shangri-Las, whose hits included Leader of the Pack, has died. She was 75. The first hit of The Shangri-Las was Remember Walking in the Sand, which reached the Billboard top 5 in 1964 for Redbird Records. Weiss was just 15 when it was charted. And another singer's death, Marlena Shaw, California soul singer, dead at 81. Marlena Shaw, the jazz and R&B rhythm and blues vocalist whose California soul was one of the defining soul songs of the late 1960s, has died. She was 81. She was a very charismatic and wide-ranging vocalist, and Shaw was best known for 1969's California Soul. Jeff?
Back to local news. In federal court, a Clinton man was sentenced for having child porn. A Clinton man has been sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison after admitting to receiving and distributing child pornography. Andrew Robert William Comstock, age 36, was sentenced January 11th during a hearing in U.S. District Court in Davenport before District Judge Stephen Locher. Additionally, Locher ordered Comstock to serve 5 years on supervised release after he completes his prison term. The maximum prison term Comstock faced was 20 years. There is no parole in the federal system. According to U.S. District Court Davenport documents, in the fall of 2022, Comstock was identified by the FBI as a member of a Kick Chat group that was sharing child pornography. FBI agents interviewed Comstock on November 30, 2022, and he admitted to receiving and viewing child porn on Kick, K-I-K. Two cell phones belonging to Comstock were seized, a Samsung Galaxy and an Apple iPhone SE. A search of the iPhone did not reveal any child porn, but the Notes application on the phone had multiple links to Mega, M-E-G-A, a known website used for the distribution of child pornography. On the Samsung Galaxy, numerous images of child porn were located. During a search of Comstock's home, agents seized an RCA tablet that also contained numerous images of child porn and multiple messages on Kick that showed Comstock was receiving and distributing child pornography. On May 9, 2023, a federal grand jury indicted Comstock on one count each of receipt and distribution of child pornography and possession of child pornography. On September 11, 2023, during a hearing in U.S. District Court, Davenport, Comstock pleaded guilty to the charge of receipt and distribution of child pornography. The charge of possession of child pornography was dropped in the plea agreement. In addition to his prison term, Locher ordered Comstock to pay $18,000 in restitution. The case against Comstock was brought in part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative to combat child sexual exploitation and abuse that was launched in 2006 by the U.S. Department of Justice. Carol?
And the Henry County Circuit Court, Toulon man pleads guilty to sexual abuse. A Toulon man on Wednesday entered an open guilty plea to one count of criminal sexual abuse in Henry County Circuit Court. Wade A. Servin, 30 years old, entered the plea to a Class 2 felony count, amended from a Class 1 felony count on criminal sexual assault. Possible penalties on the Class 2 felony include 3 to 7 years in prison, but the crime is probational. According to a factual basis for the charge, Kewaunee police met up with the victim regarding a sexual assault complaint. On May 13, 2023, she said the two had been in a dating relationship 4 or 5 years ago that had not ended well, and she had not wanted anything to do with him. He began texting her on May 12th, and between 11 p.m. and midnight, he knocked on her door and entered without her permission. He then pinned her to a wall in a hallway, and she began pushing him away, telling him she did not want sex with him. Kewaunee police interviewed Servin, who confessed that he had been to her apartment and was touching her without permission. A second count of Class 1 felony criminal sexual assault was dismissed. Judge Terry Patton accepted the plea and ordered a pre-sentence investigation and a sex offender evaluation. Sentencing was set for April 17th. Jeff?
And in national news, DeSantis ends his bid for the GOP nomination. The governor of Florida endorses Trump. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suspended his Republican presidential campaign on Sunday, ending his 2024 White House bid just before the New Hampshire primary, while endorsing his bitter rival, Donald Trump. The decision leaves Trump and former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley as the last major candidates remaining in the race ahead of Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. This is the scenario Trump's foes and the GOP have long sought, raising the stakes for this week's contest as the party's last chance to stop the former president who has so far dominated the race. But as some Trump critics cheered, DeSantis nodded toward Trump's primary dominance and attacked Haley in an exit video he posted on social media. DeSantis said in the straight-to-camera video, delivered in a cheerful tone, "It's clear to me that a majority of Republican primary voters want to give Donald Trump another chance." He continued, "I signed a pledge to support the Republican nominee, and I will honor that pledge. He has my endorsement because we can't go back to the old Republican guard of yesteryear, a repackaged form of warmed-over corporatism that Nikki Haley represents." End quote. Haley spoke at a campaign stop in Seabrook, New Hampshire, just as DeSantis announced his decision. She said, "He ran a great race. He's been a good governor, and we wish him well." She told a room packed with supporters and media, "Having said that, it's now one fella and one lady left." DeSantis' decision, while perhaps not surprising given his 30-point blowout loss last week here in Iowa, marks the end of an extraordinary decline for a high-profile governor once thought to be a legitimate threat to Trump's supremacy in the Republican Party. After months of contentious exchanges, Trump struck a more conciliatory tone late Sunday during a rally in Rochester, New Hampshire, calling DeSantis a really terrific person. "I also look forward to working with Ron to win the general election," Trump said. Well, the record wasn't enough to overcome Trump. DeSantis entered the 2024 presidential contest with major advantages in his quest to take on Trump, and early primary polls suggested DeSantis was in a strong position to do just that. He and his allies amassed a political fortune well in excess of $130 million, and he boasted a significant legislative record on issues important to many conservatives, such as abortion and the teaching of race and gender issues in school. Such advantages did not survive the reality of presidential politics in 2024. From a high-profile announcement that was plagued by technical glitches to constant upheavals to his staff and campaign strategy, DeSantis struggled to find his footing in the primary. He lost the Iowa caucuses, which he vowed to win by 30 percentage points to Trump. DeSantis' allies said that private discussions began shortly after Iowa to decide how to bow out of the race gracefully. The Florida governor notified top donors and supporters of his decision through a series of phone conversations and text messages between senior campaign officials to top donors and supporters on Sunday afternoon, according to two people who received such communications. They spoke on condition of anonymity to disclose the private conversations. DeSantis had returned to Florida by then after a roller coaster weekend that included stops in South Carolina ahead of an event in New Hampshire on Sunday evening that was ultimately canceled. Carol?
And since we have no obituaries today and no funeral notices. We'll move ahead to the opinion page. A shaky second bid is the headline. Whenever Democrats gather, a fatalistic hush permeates the proceedings. Oh, I should tell you first, this the author is Llewellyn King, executive producer and host of White House Chronicle on PBS. The cause of this quietude, his joylessness, is President Joe Biden, their leader. Day after day, polls point to his declining support and the strength of former President Donald Trump, his probable opponent, and there is very real fear as to what Trump a Trump return would mean. Night after night, we see a man who walks with extra care, carefully negotiates descending Air Force One, and often appears to teeter. He reads with difficulty, guaranteed to gaffe if he goes off script. Gone is the Biden of the Senate and the vice presidency, who never saw a microphone he wasn't drawn to, sometimes for a long time. It isn't just that Biden is 81, he's an old 81. Biden has aged quickly in his 3 years in the presidency, yet he has been deaf to calls for him to step aside, calls from party stalwarts who have supported Biden in the past, but now believe he's headed for defeat and has failed either to remove himself or up to his game. He says his desire to run for re-election is to finish the job, but it could be read as selfishness that he loves being president. The irony, of course, is that Biden is low in public esteem despite his presidency being successful. Unless he changes his tactics, those who believe he is decrepit might be proven right. The overhanging issue is his age, but not so much the fact of his age as manifestations that Biden isn't the man he used to be. He doesn't come across as a man at the helm. Watch Biden on television and see if you can imagine him as the vigorous, visionary leader of the free world. It's a hard test to pass. Who knows what motivates Biden? While he says he's running to finish the job he started, he doesn't tell us how he will go about it in a second term. Most days he is running on autopilot. Biden, once garrulous, ekes out short speeches from the teleprompter in a strained way. Biden has not delivered stirring speeches and hasn't addressed us directly on Gaza, Ukraine, artificial intelligence, or migration. Also, he's not taken the fight to Trump, hasn't landed a blow, hasn't returned on the invective, added ridicule, or gone after the myriad vulnerabilities of Trump just 3 years after Biden's junior. Biden's junior. Trump shows vigor and ensures a constant presence before the public by ranting on social media in the knowledge that the media will take the bait over and over, and it does. Not only has Biden eschewed the great speech, a staple tool in statesmanship, but he has also shamefully followed Trump's practice of not holding news conferences. Sure, this infuriates journalists, but that doesn't matter. Though not constitutionally mandated, they are part of the weave of our system. In Britain, there is Prime Minister's question time. Presidential news conferences do for America what question time does for Britain. It makes the leader explain himself or herself and defend or explain policy. The first formalized news conference in the White House began on March 15, 1933. Question time was formalized in the House of Commons in 1881. During William Gladstone's premiership. Questioning the Prime Minister had always gone on irregularly, but it was given a time slot at the end of the day under Gladstone. Now it is half an hour every Wednesday at noon. Incidentally, Gladstone stayed on as Prime Minister until he was 84. If Biden started holding regular news conferences, it would soon be apparent if he is up to the job. If he were at a loss for words, forget himself, and was humiliated, it would be clear to the whole party and those closest to Biden that he should withdraw from running for a second term. If he did, well, shown, the gloom that besets the Democrats would lift in tandem at the polls. It is time for Biden to stand up and show his stuff or leave the stage. Jeff?
Abortion rights, Trump chaos, will fuel re-election. This piece by Hank Naughton, who is the president of the Centrist Democrats of America. Naughton writes, it's hard to ignore the constant polling information. It's hard to ignore the constant polling informing us that Joe Biden will lose his re-election bid. I know many Democrats have bought into the narrative that President Biden is too old and that former President Donald Trump is likely going to win the White House. This is nonsense. Democrats are poised to win in 2024. Just look at what has happened in this country over the last 7 years. Since Trump became president, Republicans have underperformed in nearly every pivotal election. For example, just a few months ago, in a hotly contested Virginia contest, Democrats took back the state house. The Democratic governor of Kentucky, a supposed red state, was easily reelected. In the 2022 midterms, Democrats picked up seats in the Senate and barely lost the House. Historically, that midterm election should have been a bloodbath for Democrats and Biden. Why are Democrats making gains and Republicans losing elections they should win? Well, there are three answers. First, the overturning of Roe v. Wade has energized many Democratic voters. Second, Trump has branded Republicans as the party of chaos. Third, a lot of Americans are deeply concerned about the lack of respect some Republicans have for our democracy. Also, the notion that all Republican voters will vote for Trump is dubious. The GOP is deeply divided between the diehard Trump supporters and everyone else. Consider the ridiculous number of votes it took to choose two Republican speakers of the House. The Trump acolytes, including recently elected House Speaker Mike Johnson, run the party. Former Representative Kevin McCarthy was unceremoniously dumped because the MAGA crew never trusted him. On the flip side, Representative Hakeem Jeffries got the entire Democratic caucus to vote for him in every speaker vote. Even the most progressive members, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, supported Jeffries to keep the party unified. Are we supposed to believe that Democratic unity is going to collapse in 2024 under the threat of a second Trump term? Not likely. I'm not saying everything is coming up roses for Democrats. The Israel-Gaza war has split the progressives and the White House. And that'll cost Biden some votes in November. A lot of other issues have shown Democrats to be out of touch on cultural issues. For example, the White House's unhealthy obsession with forcing everyone to buy electric vehicles. My organization did extensive polling on this issue, and our findings were clear that people think EVs are only for the wealthy and that banning gas-powered vehicles is a terrible idea. As we head into election season, Biden and Democrats can point to many successes, including a strong economy, restoring American manufacturing, and standing up to Russian aggression in the Ukraine. Biden has had a solid first term. We also must remember that Biden and Trump have squared off before. We all know who won that election, even if the loser refuses to acknowledge it. But this time around, if Trump flops, he won't be able to use the considerable powers of the presidency to try illegally to remain president. Oh yeah, as we consider the coming election, I haven't even mentioned that by November, Trump may be a convicted felon. With all this in mind, I urge Democrats to stay positive. Don't keep buying the narrative telling us we'll lose the election right up until we win. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that concludes our opinions, so we'll move on to the sports. Here is what's going to be on TV to watch or listen to. Iowa Hawkeyes on Wednesday at 6 p.m. versus Maryland. And the Iowa Hawkeyes on Friday at 8 p.m. at Illinois. And the Iowa Hawkeyes versus Nebraska, January 27th at 1 p.m. Illinois fighting Illini. On Wednesday at 8 p.m., they will be at Northwestern. Illinois versus Ohio State, Thursday at 6 p.m. Illinois versus Iowa, Friday at 8 p.m. The Iowa State Cyclones, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at Kansas. Also Wednesday at 8 p.m., again versus Kansas. And Friday at 7 p.m., the Iowa Cyclones at Oklahoma. The Chicago Bulls, today at 8 p.m. at Phoenix. Friday at Lakers at 9:30 p.m. And January 28th at Trailblazers, 8 p.m. The Chicago Blackhawks, tonight, at Canucks. And the Chicago Blackhawks at Kraken on Wednesday at 9 p.m. And Blackhawks at Oilers Thursday, 8 p.m. And the Quad City Storm date is Friday at 7:10 p.m. and versus Macon on Saturday at 7:10 p.m. And here's Jeff.
Buckeyes stun the Hawkeyes. Ohio State tops Iowa in overtime. Clark scores 45 and collides with a fan. Caitlin Clark got upset and then upended. Iowa's superstar, who scored a season-high 45 points, was accidentally knocked to the floor by a fan storming the court following Ohio State's 100-92 overtime victory on Sunday. The number 18 Buckeyes rallied from a 12-point deficit in the fourth quarter to tie the game, and they took control in overtime in front of more than 18,000 fans, the largest crowd to watch a women's basketball game at Ohio State. As fans streamed onto the court, Clark, the nation's top scorer and reigning College Player of the Year, was accidentally collided into by a fan and had to be helped up by her teammates. Her coach, Lisa Bluter, said fans also screamed inappropriate things to the star player. Caitlin said she was okay, and Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith apologized to her for the incident. Cody McMahon had a career-high 33 points and 12 rebounds as number 18 Ohio State stunned number 2 Iowa 100-92, snapping a 15-game win streak for the Hawkeyes, who are now 18-2 overall and 7-1 in the Big Ten. "It's a huge win for the program," said Ohio State coach Kevin McGuff, who opened his press conference with an apology to Clark for the post-game incident. "We beat an incredible team with one of the best players to ever play our sport, and we did it in front of 18,000 people," McGuff said. "So hopefully the significance is we can really build on that with momentum." The Buckeyes, who are 15-3 overall and 6-1 in the conference, came back in the fourth quarter and tied the game at 83 to force the overtime period. A three-pointer from Rebecca Michaloskova gave Ohio State a six-point lead with 1:14 left in overtime. A basket by McMahon and four late free throws from J.C. Sheldon sealed the win. Clark scored all of Iowa's 9 points in overtime. "I don't think we were tenacious. I think we were a little lackadaisical in all areas," Clark said. Ohio State outscored Iowa 42-22 after Iowa led 70-58 with 8:55 left in regulation. Before being held scoreless in the third quarter, McMahon scored 13 in the fourth quarter and 8 more in overtime. She had 12 rebounds in the game. "As we know, I've been struggling the past couple of games," McMahon said. But you know, I kind of knew this game, my team needed me, no matter what. We refused to lose this game. Sheldon had 24 points and 7 rebounds for the Buckeyes. In the big picture, Iowa says that Clark carries the scoring load for Iowa, and it was never more apparent than in this game, in which the next highest scorer was Molly Davis with 14 points. Kate Martin and Hannah Stolke each had 7 rebounds, the latter fouling out in overtime. And the big picture for Ohio State, a signature win for the Buckeyes that should give them a big boost in the poll. Up next for the Hawkeyes, they host Nebraska on Saturday. Back to you, Carol.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. And this is high school boys basketball. Bradford playing key role for West. This is Davenport West, Devontae Bradford. At times, Devontae Bradford seems to have eyes in the back of his head. There's a reason for that. He works at it. The versatile 6'3" senior for Davenport West said he's tried to make passing a pivotal part of his game. The sturdily built Bradford said, "Ever since my sophomore year, I've worked a lot on my vision for college. Because I'm not the fastest player, I just got to be able to do everything at my body weight. Seeing the court is my biggest thing." Bradford ranked 2nd in the MAC in assists for the Falcons, who have won 7 in a row, and sit at 8-2 in conference play and 9-3 overall heading into Tuesday night's 7:30 tilt at Davenport Central. And Davenport Central is 5-7 and 4-6 MAC. Bradford is dishing out a 4.7 assists per game this season. Only Pleasant Valley's Coy Kipper at 5.7 accounts for more. Bradford, referred to as Brad by his teammates and coaches, does much more than just drop dimes, though. Bradford's 1.7 steals per game trail only Davenport North's duo of Surad Moore at 2.2 and Tenrick Brady at 1.9 in the MAC. Idris Thomas is West's top scorer and one of the best in the state, but Bradford is more than capable of filling it up. He's averaging 14.1 points per game after pouring in 22 in the Falcons' lopsided win over Clinton on Friday. He ranks 7th in the MAC in scoring. Bradford also pulls down 4.7 rebounds per contest as one of the league's most well-rounded players. Davenport West coach Dave Robinson said, "Devontae is very versatile. He does a lot of things for us out on that court. He's passionate, he cares, and we love him for that. We just need to keep everything channeled in the right direction, and that goes for everybody on our team." Bradford certainly is clutch at the stripe when it matters. He's shooting nearly 84% on free throws for the Falcons, who have caught the eye of many in the state with their string of big-time wins. Bradford said, "People are going to start watching us, seeing that we're good now. We just have to keep working, keep improving, and that will get us where we need to be." The Falcons aren't far off from being ranked in 4A. There are 3 losses this season to Iowa City West, that is, a 9-1 loss to Pleasant Valley, 6-3, and to Central DeWitt, 6-6, I guess that was a tie, are by a combined 16 points. Bradford said the key to a deep postseason run is simple. He said, "Don't get down on each other. We lost a big game against City High West because we got down on each other. When we stay together, we can beat anybody." Jeff.
Here's what to look for in this week's Quad Cities College Basketball. It's a busy week. It'll be a hectic week on the local college hardwoods as the Quad City schedule includes at least 2 games for all 6 programs. The Blackhawk College men and women are filling an open spot on their schedule with 1 makeup date, hosting Kishwaukee on Thursday in Arrowhead Conference play. That twin bill was snowed out earlier this month. The only non-conference action this week involves both BHC teams. The Lady Braves are scheduled to play in Dubuque Tuesday evening against the Clark University JV squad. Both BHC teams are in non-league play on Saturday at South Suburban. Here's this week's men's games. On Wednesday, Elmhurst is at Augustana at 7 p.m. Olivet Nazarene is at St. Ambrose at 7:30. On Thursday, Kishwaukee at Blackhawk at 7 p.m. And Saturday, Augustana at Illinois Wesleyan at 7:15. St. Ambrose at Holy Cross at 2 p.m. Blackhawk at South Suburban College at 3. This week's women's games. On Tuesday, Blackhawk is at Clark University JV at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, Augustana is at Wheaton at 7, and Olivet Nazarene is at St. Ambrose at 5:30. On Thursday, Kishwaukee at Blackhawk at 5 p.m., and on Saturday, Augustana at Illinois Wesleyan at 5, St. Ambrose at Holy Cross at 1, Blackhawk at South Suburban College at 1. Moving on up. With three straight victories and wins in four of its last five, the St. Ambrose University men's basketball team has moved into a three-way tie for third place in the Chicagoland College Athletic Conference race. Coach Ray Chauvelin's Fighting Bees, who are 10-8 and 7-3 in the conference, can move up the standings this week, hosting second-place Olivet Nazarene, who are 13-4 and 7-2 in the conference, on Wednesday before going to Holy Cross, whose record is 7-11 and 2-8 in the conference, on Saturday. Back to you, Carol.
Okay. Men's college basketball, Illinois 86, Rutgers 63. Justin Harmon scored 18 points, and Terrace Shannon Jr. added 16, to his return to lead five Illinois players in double figures as the number 14 Illini beat Rutgers 86-63 on Sunday. Shannon, in his first game back since the university was ordered to lift his suspension, came off the bench and played 28 minutes. He had four assists and made 8 of 10 shots from the free throw line. Shannon was suspended by the university on December 28th because he's facing rape charge in September incident in Kansas. But U.S. District Court Judge Colleen Loss ruled Friday that the university had violated Shannon's civil rights and granted a preliminary injunction that required Illinois to reinstate Shannon to the team. The Illini, who are 14-4 and 5-2 in the Big Ten Conference, were 4-2 in six games without Shannon, who hadn't played since Illinois' 97-73 victory over Missouri in St. Louis on December 22nd. Harmon said he was happy to see Shannon back on the floor. "Our team feels whole again. We have our best player back," he said. Teammate Quincy Guerrier, who had 15 points and 11 rebounds for his seventh double-double of the season, said Shannon was a big reason for the victory. "He got our transition game going, and he improved our defense," he said. Illinois coach Brad Underwood said he was pleased with Shannon's performance, considering he hadn't practiced with the team or played for 3 weeks. Find my spot here, folks. There it is. You could tell he was tired at times, Underwood said. He integrated in a nice way. He was pretty solid. Clifford Amorie had 22 points and 9 rebounds for Rutgers, and they are 10-8 and 2-5. Despite the lopsided score, Underwood said it was a tough win. "I have a great amount of respect for Steve," he's talking about Rutgers coach Steve Picchio, "and the Rutgers program," he said. "They make everything you do so hard." After trailing 40-28 at halftime, the Scarlet Knights closed within 55-51 with 10 minutes and 20 seconds to go on a dunk by Amorei, but back-to-back layups by Shannon in 28 seconds put Illinois in front at 60-51 with 9 minutes and 4 seconds left. Coleman Hawkins and Marcus Dalmasque each had 12 points for Illinois. And they said in the big picture, Rutgers, Amorei was the only Scarlet Knights player who gave Illinois problems offensively. While he was hard to stop under the basket, The 6'11" center also made his first three-pointer of the season on his first attempt. And Illini fans showed support for Shannon by cheering when he entered the court for pregame warm-ups and gave him a standing ovation when he checked into the game with 17 minutes and 30 seconds to go in the first half. The cheers were even louder moments later when passes by Shannon on fast breaks led to a dunk and a layup by Hawkins in 36 seconds. Shannon's reception on the road won't be as friendly.
Well, that brings us to the end of the Quad Cities Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockard. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.